way or another on this, but you're all able.
Each week, I bring you the most interesting people on the planet, the most in-depth discussions, and the most controversial issues. We go where no talk show dares to go. Join me every week for the Rob Simone Talk Show here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
To UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome, everyone, to A Global Focus, with this evening's guest, Grant Cameron, author, field researcher, and creator of the President's UFO website at www.presidentialufo.com. Welcome, everyone. This is Tree Sheridan, host of A Global Focus. Tonight's guest will be Grant Cameron. A Global Focus airs live on the International Paranormal Radio Network with anchor station UPRN 105.7 FM New Orleans, and with several listening venues. Click on the UFOParanormalRadio.com link to get all the information on the several venues. Thanks to Joe Montaldo, owner of the Paranormal Radio Network, for making these broadcasts possible. Grant Cameron, author and field researcher, became involved in ufology in May 1975 with personal sightings of an object which locally became known as Charlie Red Star. These sightings occurred in Carba, about 25 miles north of the Canadian-U.S. border. Hundreds of other people sighted objects at the same time during a prolonged flap of sightings in 1975 and 1976. Cameron also researched the work of late Wilbert B. Smith, who directed the Canadian government flying saucer investigation known as Project Magnet, in effect from 1950 to 1954. During two decades of work on Wilbert Smith, Cameron was able to collect most of Smith's files and written material. Cameron has produced a CD-ROM data disc that holds most of the documents from the Smith files, along with 12 hours of audio related to Smith's work. Years of Smith research led to the discovery of former Penn State University President Dr. Eric Walker, who was identified by Dr. Robert Sarbacher as a key person inside the UFO cover-up. Cameron teamed up with T. Scott Crane to research and write a book entitled UFOs, MJ-12, and the Government, published by MUFON. The book summed up their 3 years of research on Dr. Walker's involvement. In the past few years, Cameron has turned his research interests to the involvement and actions of the President of the United States in the UFO problem. He has made 20-plus trips to the National Archives and most of the various presidential archives looking for presidential UFO material. A FOIA, Freedom of Information Act request to the White House Office of Science and Technology, has yielded 1,000 pages of UFO documents from the Clinton administration. Many of these findings have been written up on the President's UFO website, found www.presidentialufo.com. And right now, I'd just like to make a very brief correction on this. The trips that our friend Grant Cameron has made on researching these documents have been made precisely to the, and I corrected this reference before and I didn't hear, precisely to the National... Grant, could you correct me on this, please, on the term?
Yeah, I've been to the National Archives, which is in College Park,
right,
Maryland, about five times. But most of my trips have been to the various presidential libraries, which are spread all over the United States. There's about 20 trips to the various presidential libraries.
Thank you, Grant. Appreciate it. I know I'd made that correction on my website, but I wanted to make sure I had it correctly noted here.
Yeah.
Now, at present, Cameron is releasing thousands of new presidential UFO documents at his website that have never been seen by researchers. Cameron's CD-ROM with the manuscript of the Tales of Charlie Red Star also contains the book entitled UFOs, MJ-12 and the Government, and the paper titled Presidential UFO Audio Story, which article contains 60-plus embedded UFO audio clips of the president's aides or people talking about the presidents and UFOs. Grant has lectured widely in Canada and the United States on the 1975 Karman flap, the Canadian government's early investigations into flying saucers, UFO disclosure politics, the Rockefeller UFO Initiative, and the presidential UFO connection. Impressive bio there, Grant. Welcome. We appreciate your speaking as the program guest this evening. Your research continues to yield important results, and presently you're writing a book which will summarize these excellent research findings.
Yes, well, thanks, Therese, for having me on. And I almost get tired listening to the bio. It's like it sounds like I've been working forever. I've been fairly busy, and sort of the focus has changed in the last couple of years. But my main purpose has always been to find out what was behind what I saw in 1975, because when I first got involved in this thing, I was very young, going to university at the time, and when I saw what I saw, there was no doubt that this was this is nothing of this world. It was my father's a pilot, my son's a pilot. I'm not stupid. I mean, I got some fairly close sightings, and I had a number of sightings in that 1 year period, and really haven't seen anything since. But when that flap was going on, very concrete sightings of objects, some as close as 50 feet away. So I sort of knew what I was looking at, and I basically, because I had not been really interested in UFOs, I'd been interested in life after death and stuff like that. I'd been studying at university, very fascinated, that kind of stuff. But in terms of ufology, I was sort of like, I always refer to it as you buy the lottery ticket, and you sort of think, well, maybe you'll win, but you probably won't. And that's the way it was with UFOs, because these objects were being seen, and the only reason I went out to this place about 30 miles southwest of the major city I live in, it was in the newspaper, it was on TV, it was just all over the place. The fact that this thing was there almost every night. And I went out, and when I saw the thing, I just said to myself, like, somebody has to know about this. This is like, I want to find out what the rest of the story is. So since 1975 till now, which is now going on 35 years, basically I've just been trying to find out who's got the answer, what is the real story behind this. I know it's real, so I don't spend much time with sightings and trying to prove to people that, you know, what I saw or that the fact that this is a real phenomenon. I just want to know, I know, if I know what I know, the government and people above me have to know. So I went on a process of going from one level to another. I did the sighting thing, I wrote the book on Charlie Red Star. The local publisher here in the big city where I live said, you know, you may believe in this kind of stuff, Mr. Cameron, count me among the unbelievers. Those kind of rejection letters from publishers were, nobody seemed to be interested in the sightings. They'd listen to my sighting. They're interested in the stories that I told. But I went from there to the Canadian government, to Dr. Eric Walker, and Dr. Eric Walker led to the president, and now I've sort of moved from the president into the intelligence world. And it's always been a thing of going to the next level, next level, next level, to find out who's actually, and what does this all mean.
Very intriguing. And, you know, Grant, at the time of those 1975-76 sightings in Karman, Manitoba, there were hundreds of other witnesses. You were able to interview hundreds of these individuals about their sightings. And, you know, I have to say, as far as Canada is concerned, the Canadian military and government sources do take a serious view of UFO sightings, or seem to, more so than their American counterparts, at least in the public forum. For example, in 2009, the Canadian government, through the Library and Archives Canada, a website made available to the public government documents concerning UFOs with the file sources, the Canadian National Defense Department, the National Research Council, the Department of Transport, and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. They seem to me, like yourself, to take these matters very seriously and with a fine analytical view. And I just want to congratulate you on your excellent work there. Now, Grant, before we go to your latest research, and boy, is that exciting, I just wanted to note, too, that your work on the late Wilbur B. Smith, radio engineer and ufologist, and also the director of that government investigation, Project Magnet, was also a very serious individual, apparently, you found much that intrigued you about him, and also about his excellent results as far as research.
Yeah, with him and also the people around him, because he died in 1962. I didn't get involved until 1975, and it was sort of like a lot of this was just sort of serendipity or accidental, or whatever you want to call it, synchronicity. where one event sort of led to the next, and it sort of led me to where I am right now. And I've sort of looked back and said, well, maybe some of this stuff really wasn't that much of a coincidence. And the particular incident that occurred that sort of led me to Smith was the sightings were going on in Manitoba, and one of the people I interviewed was a guy who was at the Department of Transport. My father was a pilot for the Department of Transport, the Canadian Canadian government, and they did inspections of runways, and they did the air traffic control and stuff like that. And it was a radar technician who had had a sighting. My father told me about this guy, and his name was Ernie Epp. So I went to interview Ernie Epp, and he was telling me about his sighting. And it was nothing unusual. He'd been in the Carmen area or somewhere around there and had had a sighting during that time. And so I was talking to him, and he said, you know, if you really want to know what's going on with UFOs, you should investigate Wilbur Smith. And I said, well, who is he? And he said, well, he's the guy that ran the Canadian Flying Saucer Program. And I said, well, I've never heard of this guy. Oh, yeah. He said, oh, they were landing in his yard, and he was talking to him. And I said, what? And, you know, like, it was just a bizarre story. And here's this guy. He said, I used to work for him. I was here that worked in his Flying Saucer Observatory, and he was a young engineer at the time just changing paper and stuff. So it was that led me to Wilbur Smith. And so I didn't get there till 1975 when I talked to this Ernie Epp. And so what I did was I went to Ottawa and I interviewed his wife. And his wife basically filled me in on a lot of the details of what had happened because Wilbur had already died. And she was herself a fifth year because of death in Canadian Parliament. So she was
Yeah. Grant, can I interrupt for a second? I'm going to ask the question here for the room. Are you hearing Grant well now, or should we call him right back? Guys, I'd appreciate a response quickly. Thank you. Sound was garbled. Joe, what should we do there? We have, of course, our producer and director and owner of the UFO Paranormal Radio Network on the line as well. Grant, if you could continue with that, and I just wanted to note, and if it continues to be garbled, we're going to just make a new connection because that does happen now. Of course, I'm speaking right now from the area right around Boulder, and Grant now is up here in Manitoba. Grant, I noticed as well that not only do you have your friends pilots referencing Wilbur Smith and his excellent work as well. You've also gone into the work of Dr. Walker and the fact, too, that Dr. Robert Sauerbacher was a key U.S. contact. Now, can you just say something here, Grant? I'm sorry to have interrupted you.
Okay. Well, we can just continue with Smith, and if it is garbled,
sound better.
Maybe
sound better. Uh-huh. Excellent. Your line, rather. You sound great. I'm talking about the connection. You sound just great. Great. Thank you,
okay.
Cy. Our West Virginia director just said now that the sound is good. Thank you.
Okay. Well, we were talking about Wilbur Smith, who didn't really refer to himself as a ufologist. He never used the word. He always called them flying saucers. From the time he started till the time he died, he never used the word UFO. UFO was a word that was created by the U.S. Air Force in 1952, and I think part of the reason they created it was to create confusion in the UFO, in the community. But as the research went on with Wilbur, we found out that he had told his son that just before he died that he'd been shown a craft outside of Washington, D.C. He had been shown the bodies. The fact that he had received a lot of material from the United States, pieces of hardware that were analyzed by a fellow who I was put in contact with. I talked to his wife, and his wife was so impressed that this young kid had come all across the country to talk to her that she put me in contact with the metallurgist who had worked for Wilbur. And that's when I got into this sort of a secondary group of people that had worked with Wilbur off the record quietly because they were government employees. And the one guy was a metallurgist who lived in Manitoba near where I lived. And he told me all sorts of spectacular stories about interactions with aliens and contacts and metal research that they had done. And it was just like an absolutely fascinating story. And that's when I was determined to try to get all his files, which near the end of his life, he had died of cancer of the lower bowel. So he knew he was dying. And at the end of his life, he told his wife, Merle, who told me the story personally, that he had said to her, when I die, they're going to come get my files, and I want the files to be hidden, and I don't care who comes, you don't give them the files. And she said, As soon as Wilbur died, she said, sure enough, the Americans came, the Russians came, and the Canadians came. All the Canadian, these governments came, and they all asked for his files for research purposes. And she told all of them, no, she said, I've destroyed the files, they're gone. And she pointed all the break-ins started at the house. And you could tell that the house had been broken into, and nothing had been taken. So somebody was looking for the files. And they had hidden the files for a number of years. I didn't know where the files were. But when I finally did recover the files, that's why I went out and put as many of them as I could on a disk so that other people could see them.
Excellent. Now, Grant, a question here from one of our room researchers, GOF, a fine researcher here of ICAR. And now she was just wondering, I just wanted to confirm with her that the dates when Wilbert Smith directed Project Magnet for the Canadian government, their whole investigation were 1950 to 1954. And also, Grant, you were mentioning here, this is very interesting, that Robert Sawbarker had been the individual mentioning the connection of Dr. Eric Walker, possibly with MJ-12, am I correct? Now, let me see here, am I correct here, because we have another question here from Rydell, another fine ICAR researcher. Robert Sawbarker, the key U.S. contact, apparently, quote, had been invited to briefings in the 1949-1950 period at WPAFB, which Wright-Patterson, Air Force Base, right. Wright-Patterson Air Force. Now, the subject of the briefing was the finding of a flying saucer recovery that had been made in the western part of the United States. End quote. That's fascinating. And right now, Rydell is wondering if by any chance he was able to see any of the ETs, any types.
You're talking about Sawbarker?
Robert Sawbarker, yes, thank you.
Robert Sawbarker did not. I can sort of give you the background of what fits in with Sawbarker. What had happened is Smith had, in late 1950, he had a high-ranking job. He was... he negotiated all the FM and AM with the Americans, like across the border, who would get this frequency, that frequency. So he made a lot of trips to the United States, sort of as what would later become the Department of Communications. And while in Washington, D.C., some interesting UFOs, he talked to Dorothy Hall, he talked to a number of people, and he made some inquiries to the Canadian Embassy in Washington, D.C. And at the Canadian Embassy, they put him in contact with the Defense Research Board. It's called the Joint Defense Research Board in the States, and that's when he was put in contact with Dr. Robert Sawbarker. And in September of 1950, he has this interview with Sawbarker at the Canadian Embassy, and that's when Sawbarker tells him it's the most high class I think in the United States. There's a small group running this thing. There was a crash. The flying saucers are for real. And so Wilbur Smith gets this concrete evidence, and he writes what has become famous as the top secret memo. He writes a top secret memo to the Department of Transport saying he's made inquiries to the United States. He doesn't mention Sawbarker, but he says he's made inquiries, and we now know it was Sawbarker he was talking to, and mentions Dr. Vannevar Bush as the head of the committee, and he gets authorization in December of 1950 to run Project Magnet. So he runs it from 1950 to August of 1954, and at that point he's in contact with a woman in Maine. It's sort of a long story, and she's in contact with this alien by the name of Alpha, and Smith is in contact with this Alpha, and the FBI and the CIA, and everybody's involved with this alien, and they arrange to have this thing fly over Ottawa, and Smith has this flying saucer observatory. And he has a bunch of equipment in this thing, and it's outside of Ottawa where they were picking off Russian communications. It's a highly top-secret place outside of Ottawa. And at this station, he had all this equipment to detect UFOs, or flying saucers, we call them. And this thing flies over just after they make this communication with this woman in Maine who was talking about this flyover. And he went public with it to the newspaper. And the newspaper immediately jumped on the story, and the Canadians completely shut the program down 2 days later because he had basically said, if the equipment in the Flying Saucer Observatory is working correctly, we're going to test it. If it's working correctly, we've just detected the first flying saucer over Ottawa. And Ottawa is the capital of Canada. and the Canadian government couldn't take that position, so they immediately shut the program down. So that's why it ended in 1954. But the Saarbrücker connection continues on. In 1983, when we got Wilbur Smith's notes, inside the notes there was a handwritten transcript of this interview with Dr. Robert Saarbrücker at the Canadian Embassy. And it was at that point that Stanton Friedman tracked Dr. Robert Saarbrücker down in Florida. He was retired at the time, and contacted him and said, "Is this true? Did you actually give this interview? Is this all?" And Saarbrücker said, "Yeah, this is all true. This is all accurate." And he told Stanton Friedman, he said, what had happened was he had been at the Navy building, and a bunch of people who had been to these briefings at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and we believe it was 1950 because Dr. Eric Walker was involved, and Dr. Eric Walker at that time was the executive director of the Research and Development Board in Washington. He was only there for 1 year in 1950, so we think that's when it happened. And he said he was in the Navy building, and all these scientists coming back from Wright-Patterson were standing around the water cooler talking about the briefings of this crash flying saucer, and they had brought these people in to brief them on what they had discovered about this crash flying saucer that was at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. So Stanton said, "Well, you know, weren't you there?" And he said, "No, I had to work," and he was working on the Dew Line. He had a job with the American government. He said, "I was too busy. I didn't have time to go." So Stanton said, "Well, can you name people who were there?" And he named off Von Braun, Von Neumann, the guy who sort of invented the computer. He named Bush. He named off, he was Vannevar Bush. He was naming off all these different people. And Stanton says, "Well, can't you, these people are all dead. Is there anybody that you can think of who might have been there, who still might be alive?" And he said, "Well, there's one guy from Pennsylvania who's a real arrogant guy. He thought he knew everything. And he was there. He was talking about, he was at all the meetings." And between Stanton Friedman and a researcher in California by the name of Steinman, it was actually Steinman who figured it was Dr. Eric Walker, and it was at that point when he phoned Dr. Eric Walker and said, "Dr. Walker, Dr. Saarbrücker has identified you as having been at a set of, for a crash flying saucer at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base," and Walker said, "Yeah, I was there, so what?" And that's what started this about 8-year investigation where I had a bunch of researchers from all around the world. And everybody would say, "I can get Walker to talk," and everybody was contacting Walker for about 8 years, and Walker was the type of guy who couldn't hang up the phone, but didn't want to answer the questions. He'd always say, "I can't talk about this subject, it's a subject I don't talk about," but people would keep him on the phone long enough. And then what we did when we eventually put out the book, UFOs, MJ-12, and the Government, is we just simply took all the transcripts of all the interviews and all the letters that he had answered, and we put it all in one book, and without editing anything. And if you look at all the interviews, there is a pattern through the whole thing where he confirms the fact that flying saucers are real, that there has been contact with extraterrestrials, a small amount of contact, that they have bodies, they have crafts, and that MJ-12 is for real.
Boy, that sounds like excellent research. And, you know, Grant, later, and it probably will be discussed shortly, you referenced the possible MJ-12 or Majestic connection with Bob Lazar with a very interesting piece of evidence, the copy of the W-2 wage and tax statement from 1989. That was from research of researcher Bob Oeschler, quote, formerly with NASA, end quote, that you had been able to find through your research. Now, before we get into that, I want to commend you on your excellent work there with all the FOIA applications. Is it correct, Grant, that you have filed so many FOIA requests at the Clinton Presidential Center in Little Rock, Arkansas, that they greet you when they see you?
They did it first, because what had happened was they had gotten in trouble. What had happened was, I know how the system works. The way for people who want to file, for example, Bush's files will be coming up shortly, a president has his files in the White House.
Grant, one quick question. Joe, could you help us with the connection here? It's getting a little bit warbly again. Joe, could you help? Continue right on, Grant.
Okay. 5 years after the president leaves office, he gets 5 years to put his memoirs together and use the files to whatever he wants. After 5 years, the files become open to the public. And the way they open the files is first come, first served. So if you happen to be, it always opens January the 20th, 5 years after. So if you're on January the 20th and you filed your FOIA, if you're first in line, they'll process yours before anybody else. And so what happened was I filed all my requests. I filed about 100 requests. And the reason I did was because in 2000, one of the agencies that is exempt inside the White House is the Office of Science and Technology Policy. And that was, in 2000, is the Office of Science Advisor to the President. That's where I picked up 1,000 pages of documents talking about the Rockefeller Initiative, where Rockefeller goes and tries to get the President to declassify UFOs. So I knew all the people that were involved in the Clinton White House on UFOs and all the different stories. So I filed 100 Free Information Act requests. And then what happened was, of the first 19 FOAs that were released by the Clinton Library, 11 of them were mine, and they're all on UFOs. And so Fox News and Washington Post and Associated Press and everybody jumped on this story and said, why are all these UFO reports, FOIs coming out of the Clinton White House? So they went, and then there was an agency or a group in Washington, a judicial watch, I think it's a bunch of lawyers, and they were not friends of the Clintons, and they filed, they took the Clintons to court and said that this is a total waste of time, and because Hillary was running for president, they said, we want Hillary's files, and this is an important thing, and why are you releasing all this UFO stuff? It's a bunch of nonsense, and we want to be first. So I wrote them a letter, and I said, I don't care who you guys are. You think you're a bunch of high-powered lawyers in Washington. It's first come, first serve, and go to hell. So this is what started this whole thing, and the Clintons got dragged into court by this this group of lawyers in Washington, D.C. So when I first appeared at the Clinton Library, because of my FOIs, they'd been dragged into court, and so it was at that point that they were all saying, they know who you are, and people were coming up to meet me and whatever. But in the last three or four times I've been there, it's sort of cooled off. Once the court case dropped, now they're back to doing straight business. And I would say that archivists at all the presidential libraries are basically people who are doing the job that they're being paid to do. There's no cover-up. They're as interested as anybody else in finding out what's going on. There is problems with the process, that the process is much worse. It was much easier to get documents years ago than it is now. But as for the archivists, they are doing the job, and there's the cover-up by the archivists.
Very well said. And Grant, you sound great. Keep it that direction right now. You sound wonderful now on the reception. I know it's difficult there sometimes with getting fine connections. Grant, I just wanted to quickly say this for our audience who might not be familiar with FOIA. And this is from the FOIA, FOIA.gov, G-O-V, FOIA.gov website, quote, enacted in 1966 and taking effect on July 5th, 1967. The Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, provides that any person has a right enforceable in court to obtain access to federal agency records, except to the extent that such records, paren, or portions of them, en paren, are protected from public disclosure by one of nine exemptions or by one of three special laws. Enforcement record exclusions. A FOIA request can be made for any agency record, end quote. Now, back to your great research there, Grant, I don't know whether to discuss the FOIA documents you found on President Clinton and his thanking Paul Davids for the excellent information as to the UFO subject matter, or to Area 51. Where do you want to turn next?
Where do I want to turn?
Yes, Area 51, or President Clinton and his correspondence with Paul Davids, I noticed.
I can do a little bit on the Clinton thing, because I have released a lot of material. I see not many people are really linking on to it, and I think sometimes in ufology we sort of deserve to be in the dark, that we don't have as good a communication system as many people who are protesting in New York right at the moment, where they really don't know what they're protesting about, but they're able to generate thousands of people to come to their protest. In the UFO community, we have what we think is an important issue, and sometimes the information isn't really gotten out and people don't really know. Like at my presidential UFO website, I have the first files released on Area 51 by the American government, and they were released by the Clinton Library to me. There's about 325 pages on Area 51 that we released there. And the other thing that was just released was Freedom of Information Act 2006-0474, which is the big UFO one from the Clintons. It's the one that says, give me all your files on UFOs, extraterrestrials, all this sort of stuff. And that one is 900 pages of material that I got from the Clinton Library. Many big files have just been put up at the presidentialufo.com website.
Absolutely, and the some of the pages that I've reviewed there, those FOIA documents, there are some there that are extremely remarkable and extremely important for this field. And thanks so much for your work. Very, very much appreciated there, Grant. And I know, too, how expensive it must be to get those, just get the copies, just the usual procedural cost for obtaining any copies under such a request format.
Yeah, it's but you have to do something with your money. I mean, some people, I live in the coldest major city in the world, and a lot of people here end up going down to Mexico and sitting on a beach for 2 weeks or whatever. And I go, it's all you're doing is sitting on a beach. You pay to go do that. And to me, it's like I used to do it when I was working. I would take my trips in the winter, so to go to the presidential library at the Reagan Library in just outside of Los Angeles. In the middle of January was not also bad. It's like I wouldn't sit on the beach, but I would sit in the library. But it was, you know, relaxing to go down and enjoy the warm weather. So there is an expense added, and you have to do something. And I think it's extremely important. My impression of ufology, I've been in this for a long time. I really don't think that we're going to see the answer in my lifetime. We may, but I believe for many years that we won't. And I think what is important is that we live at a critically important time in history. This is going to be a very historic moment when this thing finally is released to the public and they accept it. And we were honored enough to have played a part of the game. And I think it's up to you and I and whoever's in this field to put down what we've discovered for the generations to come, because, you know, we may not get credit for it, but 500 years from now, people are going to say, boy, I wish I had been there. I wish I had been lucky enough to be there when it started, when these people were there. And so I think it's important to record the history and record what we're doing.
Very well said, Grant. And, you know, this field just impacts so many people. It's so very important to get this information out. Now, on your FOIA document downloads regarding President Clinton and correspondence with Paul Davids, apparently Principal Clinton, rather, may well have read the books and other material which Paul Davids furnished him at rare opportunities to meet with him both during and after President Bill Clinton's administration. Paul Davids, of course, being the famous producer, director, and he received an award there for his wonderful movie, Roswell. And I also noted your speech, an interesting quote you've made. It was during a question and answer period after President Clinton's speech in 2005, quote, made to the CLSA in Hong Kong, end quote. And the entire quote you note is very, very interesting, but I'm just going to note two sentences at the end, or I'll read the whole thing if you prefer. The last two sentences are, well, you know, that's all right. I'll read the whole thing. Well, I don't know if you all heard this. I'm sorry, quote. Well, I don't know if you all heard this, but there was actually, when I was president my second term, there was an anniversary observance of Roswell. Remember that? People came to Roswell, New Mexico, from all over the world. And there was also a site in Nevada where people were convinced that the government had buried a UFO and perhaps an alien deep underground, because we wouldn't allow anybody to go there. And I can say now, because it's now been released into the public domain, this place in Nevada was really serious, that there was an alien artifact there. So I actually sent somebody there to figure it out, end quote. And also in your other research, Grant, you mentioned that this was the time, too, that George Knapp's wonderful journalism pieces on the TV there in Los Angeles were being made known, and that, too, might have brought President Clinton's interest to this field subject.
Yeah, he was fascinated in the subject. Bill was fascinated. Hillary was fascinated in the subject of UFOs. And the other person that was fascinated in their administration was John Podesta. And John Podesta actually talks about, this is when, I think when Clinton was still in, confirmed the fact that he had actually phoned Area 51 to find out whether they had aliens, because he was fascinated in the X-Files. And this was part of the interest. And Bill was interested, and when I was lecturing in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, which is sort of the home area of the Clintons, I had a woman come up to me after a lecture, and she said that her sister owned the famous barbecue restaurant where the Clintons hung out. And she was an older lady. She was in her 60s or whatever. And she said the reason that they're so interested, because I was lecturing on Clintons and UFOs, she said the reason they're so interested is either they or someone very close to them had a UFO sighting. So it was always known, even in Arkansas, that the Clintons were really interested in UFOs. And Paul Davis confirmed this when he met with Bill Clinton, and this story's on the website that you were referring to, that he has an opportunity to go when Hillary's running for president. He has this opportunity to take a lot of money, and he's trying to decide, should he go to the Hamptons for holidays or should he go to this Clinton breakfast? And he decides that he's going to go to Clinton breakfast, and he walks in there with the new Roswell books. He's sent a Roswell book back in the 90s, and Clinton had accepted the thing and sent back something confirming that they'd seen the book. So he went with another set of Roswell books that Kerry and Shootin, the latest book. He took the book and figured Clinton had to see this. And he said he went through security. Nobody checked him in security. And this was at this breakfast. And they had told him exactly how to get a hold of Bill, that Bill will speak first. And then he's going to sit beside some windows behind the podium. And then Hillary's going to speak. And as soon as Hillary finished speaking, the host said, that's when you go to talk to Bill Clinton. And because everybody's going to gather around Hillary, asking her questions and talking to her. And he said he spent at least five minutes with the former president, and he was talking UFOs, and his father had once been a professor at Georgetown University and had taught Clinton. So he had this inside track on Clinton, knew who he was. At that point, he gave him the latest Roswell book by Schmidt and Kerry, and he said Clinton looked at it, and he looked at the title, and he said, you know, I'm fascinated in this kind of stuff, and I'm going to read the book. So we knew that they were interested. We knew Podesta was interested. And apparently a lot of people, if you look at some of the Area 51 documents, they actually refer to the documents as Area 51 documents. Even though the name is still classified, the American government still will not confirm the fact that there is a place called Area 51. And yet the Clinton documents, the file, is called the Area 51 file. So it's a fascinating sort of thing. There's a lot of people in the Clinton administration who were very interested in the whole thing. And if you look at the documents, you'll see a lot of Stephen Greer stuff. Stephen Yes. Greer was putting a lot of pressure on the government. There's two very impressive files that Stephen sends. One with the Starlink in the early 1990s, and then once after they had this congressional briefing in 1997, where a couple of the Clinton people showed up, he sends a second set of material. And I guess, I'm not sure how many pages, but it's 300, 400 pages of material that Stephen Greer sent to the president. And it's very impressive. It looked like it took a lot of time to put together. So you could see sort of the background stuff going on. And I had the advantage in that I knew who the people inside the Clinton administration were who were interested in the thing that haven't been filed yet, that hadn't been put up. I've got probably another couple thousand pages of material that I've gotten, and that's based on, you know, Shirley MacLaine's letters and Gene Houston, who was involved with Hillary Clinton with this situation where Hillary got caught with channeling Eleanor Roosevelt and this kind of stuff. Those are the kinds of things I was looking for, and I did pull a lot of stuff. And the one impressive thing that still hasn't been released by them was the fact that, if you remember back the Clinton stories, when Webster Hubbell, who was the Assistant Attorney General for Bill Clinton, when he was left office in 1997, he came out with a book called Friends in High Places, and it was in that book that he said that he had been given a job by Clinton. And Clinton said, if I put you over there in justice, here's what I want you to do. I want you to get the answer to two questions. Number one, are there UFOs? And number two, who killed JFK? So, of course, when I filed my FOAs, I asked for all the UFO files, but I also asked for the JFK assassination files. And even though it had been like 40 years since Kennedy had been assassinated, I knew from the inside, from the stuff I had before, that Clinton saw himself as the second JFK. He was very famous. He had a famous picture that was taken and gotten into a speech when he was 17 years old, and he got to shake the hand of President Clinton. So he had this from the time he was 17, it was like he wanted to be the president, and he saw himself as a second JFK. So he was fascinated in Elvis Presley and also in Kennedy. So he asked, he was a conspiratorial guy. He didn't believe the UFO story. Otherwise, why would he send Webster Hubble out to find out if there's UFOs? The Air Force had already said, there are no UFOs. It's, you know, we've closed the program down. There's no national security, all this kind of stuff. Clinton didn't believe it, so he sent Webster Hubble out to investigate other UFOs because he didn't believe the story. And he also sent him out to find out about the JFK assassination because he didn't believe the JFK assassination story either. But those files, when I filed, the preliminary number that has come back is 2,500 pages of files. Now, they haven't released them yet, but according to the archivist, there's at least 2,500 pages of files on the Kennedy assassination, another investigation that was done by the Clinton administration.
Be very intriguing when you do receive those copies. And I will say one thing, Grant, and you already have a very interesting article page on the President Kennedy administration, noting as well some of the research of Linda Moulton Howe and Jim Mars. It is beautifully encapsulated. Now, you know, your excellent research on these FOIA requests and just the chain of events, I think bore tremendous fruit when I saw some of the attachments to Stephen Green's CSETI briefing. I know one of our top researchers here, Rydell, you know, is mentioning something about the attachments. Yes, we do. Grant actually has downloaded through the FOIA request process at his site attachments to the CSETI briefing that are remarkable. I'd like to get to that in maybe about 5 or 10 minutes. Right now, Grant, could we turn to your Area 51 research? It contains very intriguing concepts on Bob Lazar that not only could he well have been employed at Area 51, as well as Los Alamos, different state, but that Bob Lazar may have, in fact, been used as a conduit for disseminating information that certain parties wished to have disseminated into the public forum.
Yeah, I should maybe give the background of what happened.
Yes.
The original book that we put out called UFOs, MG-12, and the Government was put out in 1990. It was the first book ever published by MUFON. And that was the same time that the Lazar thing was going on, 89-90. And we had gotten sort of the story, and I think we had the story pretty accurate. We had been in contact. We had the whole story about the 115, the fact that they had pieces of 115. I was back in 1990, and this was not generally known till long after we published the book. But we sort of had some insight scoops about the fact that being chased on the desert and being caught in the desert, all this kind of stuff. So when I was redoing the book to update it for 2011, and I'm still not sure what's going to happen with the book, but my job was to update the book, because there's a lot of material that had come out on MJ-12 since 1990 that I had worked on. And I said, well, I better review the Lazar chapter. I thought I had it fairly accurate. So what I did, and I think you had mentioned this on your interview with Norio Hayakawa, is that George Knapp had done a number of interviews with Gene Huff, who was one of the main witnesses, a friend of Bob Lazar. He'd done interviews with Bob Lazar and with John Lear. And so I said, well, in order to do the update, I'll listen to all these interviews. And when I listened to all these interviews, there was stuff there that for 20 years I had not known. And the one key thing that sort of started this whole thing was John Lear is being interviewed and by George Knapp. And he says that there were three interviews done. When Bob Lazar was first, before he went up to Area 51, or actually S4, He had three interviews, and in the second interview, all the interviews were technical questions, and he had aced them. The only question that wasn't a technical question was the first question in the second interview. And the question was, do you know John Lear, and what do you think about him? Or no, what's your association with John Lear, and what do you think about him? Which means that before Bob Lazar was hired at Area 51, they knew that he was in contact and was friends with John Lear. Which, to me, it just changed the whole story from the idea that he had been taken up there and this, that he had accidentally got into the program or whatever. John Lear became the focus of the whole thing. The thing was not Bob Lazar. The focus was John Lear, that they knew that they were going to put Bob Lazar into a top secret program, 38 levels above top secret, and he knew John Lear. They knew it was going to get out because John Lear had already broken the Area 51 story. It was John Lear who broke Area 51, not Lazar. He had broken the story by coming out with the F-117A. That was a story that was broken by John Lear back years before Lazar went up there. And he'd also gotten onto the base, and he'd taken this picture of the MiG-21 outside of Groom Lake and had put it out, and that had embarrassed the government. So John Lear was, they knew that he was trying to get into Area 51, he's trying to get information. And so when this fact that they put Bob Lazar in there, knowing that he was friends with John Lear, completely changed the whole story, in that whatever they told Lazar, whatever they showed Lazar, they knew he was going to go back and tell John Lear, and John Lear would make it public. And that's exactly what happened, that within hours after December 6th, 1989, was the first day that Bob Lazar went to S4, within hours after he did that shift, he was telling John Lear exactly what had happened. And the second interesting thing that happened was that Bob Lazar confirmed that part of his job at S4 with the flight, all this kind of stuff, was to report on John Lear. He was to tell the security at S4 what John Lear was thinking or was involved in. So those kind of things that sort of changed the whole perspective of the Bob Lazar story, that said there's something more to this story, that the government knew before it happened exactly what was going to take place.
So indeed, it's credible to believe that perhaps Bob Lazar could have been set up. Also, you mentioned the fact that how the information about Area 51 was disseminated. Indeed, it was worldwide. You've mentioned the wonderful research of George Knapp of Las Vegas. And you also note that due to this series of investigative research reports, he received from the United Press International the, quote, Individual Achievement by a Journalist, end quote, award. And of course, that's excellent as well. Outstanding.
Yeah, I that's what I think people don't realize, is that what happened with the Lazar story was that I think the officials wanted to leak, but they didn't realize that George's story, because usually reporters will do a three-day news cycle thing, and they won't stick with the story, and he did a 6 to 8 month investigation and stuck with the story, and that's what made it go worldwide. And I don't think I've got it on my article, but if you Google search the pyramids of Giza, it comes up with 16 million hits. If you do the Wall of China, it comes up with, I don't know, 12 million hits. If you do Area 51, it comes up with like 19 million hits. Area 51 has become one of the most famous places in the world. And that the reason it is because Knapp stuck with the story, and he pushed it and pushed it and pushed it, and it didn't do the three-day news cycle, and the whole world got caught on to Area 51, and I think that was something that the government really didn't realize, that it was going to go viral, and that they would have to take another 5,000 acres and stop people, because everybody was going up there to look and see what was going on at the base, and it sort of got out of control. They've sort of got it back under control again. But they wanted it to leak and figured it would just leak and the story would get out and then just sort of die. They didn't realize it was going to become as big a story as it did.
Yes, and again, excellent research there. Grant, can I ask a couple of questions here about S4? I know from your research material that Bob Lazar's employment concerned the S4 facility, approximately 10 miles to the south of Groom Lake. Did I understand that correctly?
Yeah.
And now, am I correct also that Lazar mentioned to others, and here I'm thinking it would have been to journalist George Knapp as well, the fact that the S4 facility contained alien vehicles and also an alien being or beings also were present there.
Okay, I'll just make one clarification, because it does fit into the Clinton thing. When Clinton and both Podesta and Clinton were interested, and I don't know who they sent to Area 51, but they go to Area 51 and they say, do you have crash flying saucers at Area 51, at Groom Lake? And they say, no, that's true. It wasn't, and Lazar has pointed this out. There was nothing. Oh, at Groom Lake, do not know what's going on. S4 is the place where it's actually taking place. So he was stationed at S4, and he only went up there a couple of days. He actually was only up there a couple of times, and so there's a distinction between S4 and the Groom Lake facility, which is a completely different type of thing. Now, I sort of lost track of your question. What was your question about S4?
Am I correct? As I was reading, it seemed to me that included in your research was the fact that Lazar might have mentioned to others, including George Knapp, the investigative journalist, the fact that the S4 facility contained alien vehicles and also an alien being or...
stated that he had seen at one point one vehicle when he came in. And this is the sports model that he had actually gone inside. He was the only one who went inside. And later he stated that they, at one point, he saw nine hangars. And there's nine different types of UFOs. Each one had a different one in it. The thing about the alien is actually kind of interesting because when you listen to John Lear tell the story, this is he gets the job December the 6th, 1989. In January, the next month, he's up there. And that's at one point when he goes to the bathroom and you're escorted by security guards when you go to the bathroom. So he's going to the bathroom, he's walking down the hall with these two security guards, and he looks in a window. There's a window of a laboratory, and this 9x9 window, he sees what he thinks are two physicists or technicians looking in his direction. And they're standing there, and what appears to be an alien has got his back to the window, and that's all he gets is this quick glance. And the small alien and these two technicians looking down at the bathroom, he comes back out and he goes back the second time, he doesn't see anything in the window. So again, he runs to John Lear's house in Las Vegas and he says to Lear, he says, "You'll never know what it's like to see your first alien." So that's when the story about the alien thing comes out, that he saw the alien. But since it went public, Lazar has always denied that was an alien. He now says, "I don't really think it was an alien. I think it may have been a dummy that they set up to put inside the craft." And he even went to the point where there was a number of Hollywood people who wanted to do movies on Bob Lazar's story. They had optioned this thing a number of times, and one of the conditions that Bob Lazar had for optioning the movie is they could not talk about that alien encounter. Because he now did not believe that it was an alien. So he's backed off the alien story. The story he still will admit is true, what he saw in the window, but he is really backed off the alien thing, and to the point where he said, "You're not going to do the movie if you put the alien thing in there."
Boy, that's a very intriguing response there. Thank you, Grant. Now, we have about 2 minutes before the first break, for about 8 minutes. Could I just make this comment here? I'll make it quickly because our guests, our listeners, want to hear you. You're the guest. You're the expert. Grant, that S4 facility recalls the great presentation made by Michael Schrat, the military aerospace historian, at last February's International UFO Congress in Scottsdale. Michael Schrat's presentation, in a credible format, very credible, summarized Dan Bursch's knowledge of the S4 facility, the UFO craft, and reverse-engineered models contained in the first level, and in the lowest level, the biosphere of the extraterrestrial being J. Rod. Also, Grant, I just wanted to note, too, from your research, I note here that Bob Lazar was reported to have read classified documents on, quote, Project Galileo, end quote, focusing on gravity and propulsion, and on a second project, quote, Project Looking Glass, end quote, involving, quote, the physics of looking back in time, end quote. But that Lazar just worked on the gravity and propulsion project. What are your thoughts on that? And, Joe, can we extend this like 1 minute? I have a feeling he's going to have probably a longer answer. It's going to be interesting. I know that.
Okay, I saw Schrat's presentation. I was there. The problem with Schrat's presentation is based on, what's his name? You mentioned him. And
Dan Bursch, yes.
Dan Bursch. And George Knapp says Dan Bursch is not a real story. He said, which makes it sort of fall apart. I'm really not that familiar, but I take Knapp at his word. Like, Knapp is there. He's got all the inside sources and has done the investigation. That's that part. So it's hard to comment on the Bursch. I saw Bursch interviewed the year before, and I saw the presentation, which Schrat did an excellent presentation. But and Knapp says, and I think I hold Knapp in very high regard, said that there's no truth to the story. So,
But you do think, though, that when Lazar is reported to have that when Lazar was reported to having said that he read the two material on the two projects, one Project Galileo and two Project Looking Glass, that there actually might have been a Project Looking Glass.
Well, there may, but that's where it comes down to. You've got a question now. Once you know they put them in there on purpose, you got a question, and I do that in the article when they rewrote the chapter, is you've got to question everything he says, like, or what he was shown. Is he being shown that to throw everybody off? Or is that the true thing? Because if you have a security clearance and it's compartmentalized, you're only told what you need to know about your project. Why did they show Bob Lazar 121 or 122 briefings on all sorts of stuff that had nothing to do with what he was working on? It doesn't make any sense that they're going to show him about other projects that he's not going to work on, because that's not how compartmentalized information works. You're only told what you need to know to run your project. So he was showing a lot of stuff, but there is, we can do it after the break. There's one specific story that shows that he was fed material that wasn't right, and I can talk about that after the break.
Interesting. Now, Grant and everyone, we'll be taking a brief intermission here for 8 minutes. We'll be right back with this just fascinating discussion with Grant Cameron during the break. Grant has more than one website, but his principal one is at the President's UFO website at www.presidentialufo.com. We'll be right back in 8 minutes. Thank you. Welcome back to the second hour of A Global Focus with guest Grant Cameron, author, field researcher, and creator of the President's UFO website at www.presidentialufo.com. Welcome back, everyone, to the second hour of our interview with Grant Cameron. Site again, www.presidentialufo.com. Wonderful site, remarkable material and research. Also, for our listeners on the International UPRN Network, don't miss on Friday evenings the show immediately prior to this one, Through the Keyhole with Karen Dolan. And please don't miss that new and very interesting and dynamic show, Second Sight New York City, with hosts Chris George and Stephanie Benetti. Their Second Sight New York City program next week will feature as guest Christopher Lutz, the Amityville son who lived in the house with the rather horrific occurrences occurring therein, paranormal occurrences, that is. Let's get right back to you, Grant. I'm learning so much from this discussion. Now, Grant, on Area 51, two more quick questions. I was noticing, too, from your research, Grant, some people have noted that the Air Force is calling a unit at Nellis Alien Technology Center. And also on the S-4 facility, is it the Air Force or the Office of Naval Intelligence Office of Naval Intelligence, who is the ultimate responsible party for operating that facility?
The Alien Technology Center, I've tried to get more material. The only thing we had was the one reference, and that was in this, I think it was a Gung Ho article or something back in the 1989-1990 period. That's the only reference we got to that, and that was the tech guy, the aerospace tech guy that came up with that. We've got nothing more on that. The other item you wanted to know about was?
Yes, on the S-4 facility, and also Area 51 itself, is the Air Force, is it operated under the aegis of the Air Force, or is it the Office of Naval Intelligence?
Okay, that's a good question. Everybody thinks it's the Air Force running it, and right back from the time that we investigated with Wilbur Smith, when I was talking to these inside sources, like this metallurgic guy, and there was his wife and stuff, and his son, and I would say to them, who is he talking to in the United States? Who was Wilbur Smith's contacts? And everybody said they were pretty sure it was Navy people. And so the Navy has always played a part. And I don't know if your listeners recall back in 1988, there was a big UFO special. And at the time when it was running, it was sort of rumored to be a big disclosure when the Condor and the Falcon first showed up in backlit and talking about the aliens and strawberry ice cream and all this kind of stuff. In that show, I remember Billy Cox from, at the time he was writing for Florida Today, which is part of the USA Today chain. Billy Cox and I were talking about this, and I remember on that show they stated that the Navy was in charge and that the head of MJ-12, which ran the whole thing, was headquartered at the Naval Observatory. And I remember Billy Cox contacting me the day after this documentary took place and said that he'd actually phoned Office of Naval Intelligence and this place in Washington, the Naval Observatory, and asked them, is there MJ-12 there? And these people said, well, we're getting all these phone calls. We don't know what you're talking about. The Navy is, I would say, if you're going to take a guess, it's the Navy, the people who are running it. It's the Navy, it's national security, but it's the Navy. And there's so many different references that have come up, and Lazar is only one of a number of references who have said that the Navy is the key organization that's running it. And looking back, go back to 1946, you can see, 46, 47, you can see maybe why that's true, is because if you take a look at the funding, the research funding given out by the U.S. government in 1946, the year before Roswell, almost all of it went to the Navy because the Air Force was not there, and the Army was not that important. So the Navy in 1946, when this thing, 47, when it first started, the Navy was the big military operation that was going. And it's like anything else in the military. If you suddenly get control of something, just because someone says, oh, it's actually should be somebody else, this is money, this is funding, this is your bureaucracy, you're not going to give it up. So that's why I think the Navy has always controlled it, is because they were the people who had it when they first started to realize that they had this phenomena on their hands, that they had to figure out what was going on. It was the Navy was running it, and they're still running.
Thank you so much for that information, Grant. You know, I was looking at some of this material here for your research. The copy of the W-2 wage and tax statement from 1989 for Robert S. Lazar. It says here the employer's name, address, and zip code, United States Department of Naval Intelligence, Washington, D.C., 20038. And I mentioned before, and boy, I thought that was fascinating, too. You, of course, correctly attributed research contribution of Bob Oeschler, O-E-S-C-H-S-L-E-R, as you note, quote, formerly with NASA, end quote, who did note that the marking E6722 MADGE, Department of, I should put this in quotes here, quote, stood for the Department of Energy, Kirkland Air Force Base, with MADGE, M-A-G, as the point of origin, end quote. Now, is that showing not only the naval influence there, but also MADGE, Majestic?
Yeah. He did link in the Majestic, the Majestic connection as well. Hang on here. He did bring up the Majestic connection, but that could have been something that was added later on because of of the majestic thing had already been public, because 2 years before, Bill Moore, Stanton Friedman, and Jamie Chandry had released the MJ-12 documents. So because of the majestic, it doesn't really prove back up mm-hmm. majestic. But the other part is very interesting with this document, because and I haven't really gotten the details, because George Knapp mm-hmm. really, I guess he gets so many questions, he hasn't really answered this, but there was a court case in 1990 where Lazar was brought into court on a pandering charge, and this was brought in as a piece of evidence in the court case. And there was a congressman by the name of Bill Bray, who was, I guess, the congressman in charge of Las Vegas and the Area 51 area, who actually helped George Knapp, and they were trying to get all Lazar's material, all his files and his records, and they actually tried to track back through the IRS the money that was paid to Bob Lazar. So Knapp actually had a congressman working for him, which is kind of an important thing. I'm starting a blog site, which I'm going to write some articles, and one of the articles I'm going to write on is about disclosure, how to get more reaction in terms of disclosure, because what people are doing now is they are taking the disclosure to the president and to the Congress, and if you take a look back in history, you will see that there has been a lot of success in terms of UFO disclosure by going not to the congressional level, but going to personal congressmen. If you take a look at all the different times that we've had actual action where the government's had to react to UFOs, is, for example, Gerald Ford. Gerald Ford was a congressman in Michigan, and because there was a big UFO flap in Michigan, Gerald Ford was contacted by a number of his constituents, and he went and forced a congressional investigation on UFOs. And if you take a look at, in this case, Bill Bray, who was the congressman, was actually working on behalf of George Knapp, trying to get to the bottom of this UFO thing. If you take a look at Schiff, who was the congressman in New Mexico, when the whole Roswell thing started to break, he pressured the government to do an investigation. He forced the Air Force to do a Roswell investigation, and the General Accounting Office did an investigation of Roswell. That was at a congressional level. So what I would say to people is, if you want to get disclosure, if there's an event that happens in a part of the country, the best thing you can do is to put tremendous pressure on your personal congressman, because that provides them cover. If you're in the government, if you're the president, or if you're a congressman, you have no cover. And they don't want to deal with the UFO subject because it's going to cost them votes. But if you're at a congressional level and you are, say, a Schiff, you can say, I'm really not interested in UFOs, but my congressional people are asking for these questions to be answered, and they've got a cover. And that's what they need, because nobody wants to touch it because it's such a toxic issue. But you get situations, and another example is Harrison Schmitt, who was a senator in New Mexico. A lot of people don't know, actually had an investigation. He ran an investigation on cattle mutilations because he was the senator in New Mexico, and he was getting a lot of phone calls from angry ranchers in New Mexico, and he actually stepped up and pushed the issue. And there's examples going all the way through. There was in the Bush administration, when they first came in, George Bush had promised UFO disclosure to a researcher by the name of Charles Huffer. And at that point, there was actually an actual protester, a professional protester, and her name was Laura Johnstone. I don't know if you know this story. Laura Johnstone was in California. I got to know her, and she actually went on a hunger strike against George Bush and Dick Cheney, saying, I want him to release the UFO information. He promised Charles Huffer that he would release UFO information, and I'm going on a hunger strike. She went on a hunger strike for 42 days. She was on the media all across the United States of America, and she actually had the backing of Barbara Boxer, who is a major political person in the San Francisco area. And she was writing letters on behalf of Laura Johnston, and that's what you do, is these people, if you can get at that congressional level, if you're in the Roswell area, or if you're in the Area 51 area, if you can pressure the congressman has a way of himself and going after the material, and all the material that has the sort of the highlights of UFOs over the last 40 years has always been these congressmen that have taken up the issue. But if you're a congressman at the main level and you don't have the backing of your people, for example, Kucinich, who had the sighting at Shirley MacLaine's house, was congressman out of Ohio, but he didn't have any backing from his people. He just got sort of caught in the crosshairs of being involved in this UFO thing, and it just basically ruined his career. It just knocked him out of the presidential race, and it didn't help him. But if you're at a local level, if you're somebody at a local level and there's sightings, the one thing you can do if you want disclosure is to put congressman and make that congressman ask official questions to the government, and the government has to answer those questions.
Wonderful points there. And just very quickly, number one, I'd want to mention again your great website, presidentialufo.com. Under the material regarding President Gerald R. Ford, it includes, for example, Gerald R. Ford's statement, quote, a statement by House Minority Leader Gerald R. Ford, Republican, Michigan, on the air, 2 p.m., March 25th, 1966, end quote, when President Ford was a congressman at the time. I believe Congress should thoroughly investigate the rash of reported sightings of unidentified flying objects in southern Michigan and other parts of the country, quote. And then just down at the very end, quote, I think the American people would feel better if there was a full-blown investigation of these mysterious flying objects, which some persons honestly believe that they have seen, end quote. And also, your very brave question to Vice President Dick Cheney made during the Diane, is it pronounced Ram, R-E-H-M, Diane Ram PBS radio program of April 11th, 2001. And here I'm quoting from the www.roswellproof.com webpage, and it's the webpage for General Wesley Clark, but it also mentions your very brave question. Cheney, a quote from this www.roswellproof.com page, Cheney had been a senator and also Secretary of Defense under President George Bush, Sr., before becoming Vice President. And Cameron asked Cheney whether he had ever been briefed about when he was in the government. To this, Cheney replied, subquote, well, if I had been briefed on it, I'm sure it was probably classified, and I couldn't talk about it, end subquote, end quote. Boy, good for you.
Yeah, that's another important thing that I sort of point out when I lecture and talk to people. If you want disclosure, people want it out there, one of the things that you can do is pressure your local congressman, and the other is if you ever run into a person who you think may know, for example, a president, a vice president, a four-star general with a unified command, who's somebody who had been briefed, the thing that you are to get to them, if you get a chance to ask the big question, is not the question, what do you think about UFOs? Did you ever have a UFO sighting? Don't ask those questions. The question you ask is, have you ever been briefed on the subject of UFOs? That means the truth. Did anybody ever, in an official capacity, walk into your office and say, briefing on UFOs, and here you have to sign for the security and all this sort of stuff. Did you ever get an official briefing telling you what the truth was? That's what you need to know. And as you referred to General Wesley Clark, what had happened was I had asked a question of Dick Cheney, this briefing question, and it got a better response than I thought he was going to give me. And then what happened is in 2004, there was the race for president, and General Wesley Clark, who was a four-star general with the Unified Command, when these people are briefed, was running for the Democratic Party and was in the lead. And he was in New Hampshire, and he made this famous speech where he was asked by Jay Buckley, who was a space shuttle commander. He said, General, what's your vision on space? And he said, well, you know, I wanted to be an astronaut. My sight wasn't very good, and I had to go into the Army, and so I worked my way through the Army, but I actually wanted to be an astronaut. And then he starts talking about the fact that he believes that we can go past the speed of light, and I've argued with physicists, and I believe we can do it. And I'm going, like, this is just bizarre. Here's a guy running for president, at that time was heading the Democrats. He was in the lead for the Democrats, and he's suddenly talking about the fact we can go past the speed of light. And then I got an email from somebody saying, that was related to the Avery, which is this group of inside intelligence type people. One of the birds tells me that he's been briefed on crash flying saucers. So at that point, I made an alert to all the MUFON state directors that I could find, because we knew where Clark was going from state to state, and I was asking them, get Clark in a town hall and ask him the question, have you ever been briefed on flying on UFOs? And on a couple of occasions, two or three occasions, I had MUFON state directors tell me, we don't want to ask him the question, I don't want to embarrass him, which, of course, gives back the response, well, if we don't want to embarrass him, why should we expect the government to go out and deal with this problem? This is our problem. This is ours to ask. And if we don't ask the question, don't expect the media or the government to ask the question. Nobody would ask this guy the question until it came to, he was in Reno, Nevada, 2 days before the election. He was campaigning. He dropped out, and he was campaigning for Kerry at the time, who was running against Bush, I guess it was. And David Rudiak, who's a friend of mine in outside of Berkeley, saw that he was lecturing, already turned down the chance to ask him a question earlier, and said, well, I'll go ask him the question. And he stood up to, after Clark had lectured, and said, have you ever been briefed? And we got another positive response. He said, I know something. I know a little bit. And then he started talking about mathematics and stuff, and we basically got a positive response. So that's the question you want to ask. If you get somebody who's in a very high, powerful position, the question you want to ask him is, in your government position or in your military position, have you ever been briefed on the subject of UFOs? And see what they say.
That's excellent information. Thank you, Grant. And also, thank you for referencing David Rudiak's name. He actually is the author of the page here at this www.roswellproof.com website, the page related to General Wesley Clark. It's entitled General Wesley K. Clark on UFOs by David Rudiak. And November 3rd, 2004, last updated September 2010. Now, Grant, here if we get back to Bob Lazar, I have a final question on that. You had noted an interesting observation in your research that Dr. Teller Grant, in your research, you also note that a former reporter of the Las Vegas Bullet, I believe it is, Las Vegas Bullet newspaper, Tony Pelham, investigated the claim. Lazar had indicated to Pelham that Dr. Teller was instrumental in his obtainment at one point. Dwight Teller had an interest in UFOs as well. Did Dr. Teller, number one, have anything to do with Lazar gaining employment at either Los Alamos or Area 51?
This is the story. The original story started in 1982 when Teller appears at Los Alamos, and Lazar is working there. And according to Lazar, he was going to Teller's lecture, and the day before Teller was to lecture, the local paper in Los Alamos had written a story on Bob Lazar about a jet engine car that he had built. And Teller is sitting outside the lecture hall, and he's reading the newspaper, and he's actually reading the story on Bob Lazar. So Bob comes up to him, and they have just this sort of interaction and discussion about, minor things, not about UFOs or anything like that. And Teller lectures. And so in 1989, when John Lear talks Bob Lazar into trying to get a job at the test site, he sends out applications to various places to get a scientific job, and he sends one to Edward Teller and reminds him of the fact that they had this meeting at Los Alamos in 1982. And it was, as the story goes, according to Lazar, he's phoned, I think it's November the 29th, Edward Teller phones him and says, I'm not involved anymore, I'm just a consultant. Where would you like to work? Would you like to work at Lawrence Livermore Lab, which is where Teller was working as a professor emeritus, or do you want to work in Nevada in the area where you're living? Because he's living in Las Vegas. And he said, I'd like to work up at Groom Lake. And so that was how, according to Lazar, he got the job. Now, Teller does have a background in UFOs that we've always known about, and that was that he was involved with Project Twinkle, which was back in the late 40s. There was all these green fireball things that were being seen in New Mexico, and that the U.S. Air Force had actually had a project called Project Twinkle, which Edward Teller was involved with. And after the whole Bob Lazar thing took place, Teller was confronted about did he know Bob Lazar during an interview, and Teller was a very sort of an old grumpy type guy, and you could tell by the reaction that they had gotten a reaction out of him. He said, you know, I don't really know, I mean, maybe I did know this guy, and basically wanted him to turn the camera off, didn't want to talk about it. So there is this Teller connection, and the Teller connection has always been that there's this MJ-12, this group of 12 people, and the rumors when Teller was alive that he was one of the 12 people that was in charge of running the program, that he was one of the key people that was involved, that ran the UFO cover-up.
Thank you so much, Grant. You know, I was going to reference your research note that there was a rumor in the late 1980s that Teller was an MJ-12 member. Also, am I correct here that there was a secret 1948, quote, conference on aerial phenomena, end quote, focusing on UFO phenomena, and that the conference was held at Los Alamos? I hope I got that correctly. Boy, that's interesting.
Yeah, and that's Project Twinkle.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you very much. And now, you know, Grant, we've got another interesting, very interesting question from our senior researcher here, one of our senior researchers, Rydell. And actually, it's a question I think all of us would like to know. Let me get right down to it here. Oh, heavens. It's right up here. We have so many questions coming in. Let's see. Thank you for your patience. I hope so. So one knows it's up here. If not, I know I can just paraphrase it, though I don't like to do that. I like to make it as precise as possible. Here it is. A question for you, Grant. Bush Sr., former head of CIA, must have known a lot. How much info do you think, Grant, President Bush Sr. would have told President Bush Jr.?
Well, there's a story about that, and that gets into this whole intelligence aspect in the later couple of years after I sort of gave up on the presidents and went to look at what intelligence agencies and who inside the intelligence agencies might know. There was a lot of stories about both the Bushes. And again, it goes back to this Charles Huffer. Charles Huffer was a guy in Arkansas. What would happen is every time there was a presidential election, the Bushes would fly back to Texas to vote. And they would always fly through Arkansas, and they would land at Fayetteville, Arkansas, on the way back to Texas. And Huffer was always waiting for them. And so Huffer got to interview both Bush Sr. and both Bush Jr. on UFOs. And he asked Bush Sr., he said, come on, you're CIA, you know what's going on, tell us a story about UFOs. And that's when Bush said, yes, I know some, yes, I know a lot. So we had this idea that Bush Sr. had known. He was always rumored again to be one of the key people on the inside circle who knew what was going on. Now, when Bush Jr. came in, there's a story that's told by Dan Smith. And I was on this because I was working on the presidents then back in 2000, and it went on a Jack Sarfati's list where they're talking about a briefing. And if your listeners probably know about the weird desk, there's always been sort of a person in charge of the UFO files at the CIA. First guy was Arthur Lundahl during the 1970s, then it was Kit Green, and then it became Ronald Pandolfi. And Ronald Pandolfi was the guy who was asked by Clinton's science advisor for a briefing on UFOs. So we know that when the White House wants a UFO briefing, they go to Ronald Pandolfi. Now, he can claim he's not involved in UFOs, not interested, or not involved with the files or whatever, but that rumor is always there. Now, in 2000, Dan Smith, who's a very close friend, and has said he's had 1,000 conversations with Pandolfi, said that he was talking to Pandolfi about a briefing for Bush, and why don't they do it? So there's a couple of stories that peddled, and one was that they sent James Woolsey in there to brief him, and James Woolsey told Bush Jr., or Bush Sr. sent Woolsey in there to brief him, and that Woolsey told Bush Jr., you don't have a need to know. The other story that's told, and I've got it on my website, and it's still on Dan Smith's website as far as I know, that when Dan Smith asked Pandolfi, can we do a briefing for Bush Jr.? Supposedly, and it's on his website, Pandolfi turns to him and says, no, the president, when it comes to Bush, the Bush briefing, the presidents cannot be players. We tell them what they need to know and hope we don't have to put them down, which is just a dramatic statement. I mean, so these are the stories that go about Bush that there was big pressure. I know, because I was involved in 2000 when this was going on, there was pressure by a bunch of people on the East Coast to try to get a briefing for Bush. And the other thing that Pandolfi had said is, in order to brief Bush Jr., you have to brief him before he's inaugurated. And I asked Dan Smith, I said, why is that? And he said, that's just how it works. So there are these rules. We're talking to the government has all these bizarre little rules about how things work. And one of the rules appears to be that once he's the president, you can no longer tell him what's going on. You have to tell him before he becomes president. Now, I don't know what that means or, you know, how true it is, but I think that's basically, it doesn't make much sense, but it was told to me at the right time, and I think that's a true story, what they said about that.
That information is very, very thought-provoking. Thank you, Grant. And right now, I would like to turn to the Greer material, the FOIA articles that have been downloaded at your website, presidentialufo.com. Before that, I just want to note to everyone's attention the Silas Newton article page. Grant, you know in an article at your website that Silas Newton, quote, was one of the key people involved in the 1948 Aztec UFO crash, end quote. That sounds very, very interesting. You note that at one point, Silas Newton had made an interesting comment to Harold Sherman, a paranormal field author, Newton seeing at one point alien bodies, end quote. That would be a very interesting thing to keep in mind there for future FOIA downloads.
And the key part of that was that Newton was always seen as a fraud, and the reason it interested me and why I went all down to Arkansas to look at Sherman's files is that he stated that he had gotten access to the bodies, to seeing the bodies, through Wilbur Smith. And Wilbur Smith was a Canadian. He's the last guy in the world that the Americans would be showing bodies to because he wouldn't have a security clearance. He's a foreign national. He wouldn't have access to that kind of classified material. And when Newton said that Smith had showed him the bodies, had gotten him access to the bodies, that rang as true because I knew from the inside, having worked with Smith's son, Smith's wife, and his inside people, that the story was that Smith had seen the bodies, and that was not generally known by anybody in the UFO community except for me. That's why it was so significant that Newton claimed he'd seen the bodies through Wilbur Smith, because it didn't make any sense why somebody from another country would be showing him the bodies in the United States.
Boy, that's intriguing. And you know what's remarkable as well, Grant, is your information regarding the Stephen Greer, documents obtained through FOIA, the copy of his CSETI DC briefings, April 7th through 11th, 1997. To me, what are particularly fascinating is not only his the arguments are really presented very well, but also the attachments. For example, the first one, or I don't know if it's first in order, but what I've saw at least three of the attachments. Now, one of them regarded actual Air Force documents containing log entries by the 24th NORAD region senior director's log describing the sightings of UFOs at Montana's Maelstrom Air Force Base during the nights of November 7th through 8th, 1975. Remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Stephen did do a very good job on this material. I sort of apologize to people. I have to sort of tell the story. Some of the documents are kind of dark, and I can tell you the sort of story behind this. It's kind of weird. I've been to the Clinton Library to research a number of times. Every time they get a pile of stuff that sort of has been released to me, then I go down there. It's worthwhile going and doing it. And they have two people sitting in the research room, and I'm always the only person in the research room. And so I'm using a camera. I'm really not reading the documents or everything. All I'm doing is photographing the documents as fast as I can and photographing everything without editing anything. And so I'm photographing, and the light is very bad, and I can't get the camera to focus. So I said to the woman, there's two of them, they were just sitting and looking at me, and I said, well, can I go near the window? I can't get this thing to focus properly. And the photographs were coming out dark. So if you see the material from the Clintons, it's dark. And, well, we have to watch you. And I said, what do you mean you have to watch me? I mean, there's like 17 tables here. And I said, well, I just can't photograph these things. And they said, well, you can go in front of us and you can go near the window, but you got to stay in front of us. It was just the most bizarre thing. It was like that. It's all they did all day was sit there and watch me. So I apologize to people. The lighting wasn't very good in the room, and I was doing the best job I could to try to photograph these documents. But the Greer stuff is really good, and you can tell by reading this material that he spent a lot of time. And what some people don't realize is that the same documents that he attached there, the same sort of briefing that he provided for Bill Clinton, he also provided for Lawrence Rockefeller. And if you look at the documents, you'll see a document, Stephen Greer in contact with Clinton's communication guy, talking about Lawrence Rockefeller going to the ranch, and I'll be here, and you can phone me if there's anything comes up. And the reason he was talking to the communications guy for Clinton was the fact that all the documents that Rockefeller had at the ranch when he talked to the Clintons in August of 1995 were provided by Stephen Greer. So that was the material. Rockefeller was using Stephen Greer's material, and they later had a follow-up, but this was material that he had collected, and he had provided twice. He had all the attachments you'll see in the first segment in 1993 when he sends it, and then the second one in 1997. There's a lot of documents that Stephen Greer has gathered up and attached to these, to this sort of proposal, and he's pushing. And what I was trying to find was Stephen Greer had always told the story that he had briefed Clinton, that there was a friend of Bill Clinton's that he had that had sat down with the president and had showed him all the material and had briefed him, and then had come back to Stephen Greer and said, the president would like to do what you say, but we're afraid that he'll end up like JFK, and started laughing, and the guy said, no, we're serious. The president actually doesn't want to do it because he's afraid he'll be killed. So that's what I was trying to find when I was trying to find I did an FOI on Stephen Greer, UFOs, and that's what I was trying to find out, is who was this guy that Stephen sent in, and I still don't know who it is. It was a guy that, a friend of the president's, who actually went through those documents with him. So those are the kinds of things, and sometimes you get lucky, sometimes you don't. But I had all the names of the different people, and that's what these FOIs were trying to do, is to try to nail down one of these things. But as I said when I first started the interview, is that the way documents work in the FOIA now, there's so much material that doesn't get released that used to get released. I mean, it's just unbelievable. There's even I put on my Facebook today, last year 77 million documents were classified by the U.S. government. That's a 40% increase over the year before. The secrecy has just gone crazy. It's just, and the one exemption that they're using that used to be really good that they are now using is the P5 exemption. And that is an exemption that even Hillary Clinton was using, and that is an exemption that says if you had a conversation or an interaction with the president, all that stuff is exempt, which means that any sort of decision that comes to the president about, you know, whatever he's doing overseas or here, anything that you can say that was a discussion with the president, or it was I don't want to release it because it connected to the president, all that basically takes the whole president out of the whole thing. You can't tell, like, for example, the Watergate tapes would now be exempt because you can't. That was presidential material. That was people talking to the president. That would all be exempt today. And the P5 exemption is knocked out anything that has to do with the president, and so you're left with all these sort of just documents that really don't get us anywhere. The majority of the material is being withheld, and even as I said, the one that I fought with them and I went through all the appeals was the John Podesta one. John Podesta, when Bush was in, John Podesta was really pushing for UFOs. He went in front of the sci-fi news conference and he said, you know, UFOs should be disclosed, we should know the truth, all this sort of stuff, and he makes this big speech, and as soon as Obama gets in, then suddenly he goes silent. And it's because now he's the guy that's going to get the president into trouble if he starts to push it, because he can't speak on behalf of the president. And the one thing I was fighting for was the photographs from John Podesta's 50th birthday, which happened when Clintons were in. And they fought me all the way through. There's 83 photographs and there's one videotape. And they fought me all the way through the photographs for John Podesta's 50th birthday, which was held at the White House. They refused to release it. It went to Bill Clinton and to Lindsay, who was his lawyer, and they turned it down. I appealed it. I went through every appeal I could. I lost. They are not releasing a single thing. And the reason they're not releasing the pictures from John Podesta's birthday party is because Bill and Hillary Clinton, it was an ex X-Files birthday party. John Podesta was an X-Files fan, and they had an X-Files birthday party, and Bill and Hillary dressed up like the X-Files, and they had this birthday party. And so it's an embarrassment. They don't want to release it. So that kind of material is not being released. A lot of the really good stuff, if it's embarrassing or if it's going to tell stuff, there's so many exemptions today in the FOIA that I don't think we're really getting anything close.
Boy, that information is somewhat disheartening, but excellent explanation there on the updates of access through FOIA. You know, another FOIA document which was attached to the SETI briefing material. Actually, and I can just mention two of them here just briefly because of the time limits, and we want to hear more from you, Grant. First is, it was a moving document. It was a FOIA document, which was a letter to the president. It noted in an individual, quote, proud American naval submarine veteran, end quote, and who had, quote, held a security clearance in the Navy aboard Polaris submarines and worked on nuclear warheads, end quote, calling for President Clinton to release to all records of government and military records concerning UFOs, that the American people had the right to this important information. And just the last one I'd like to mention, and there are several others, believe me, fascinating material here. It is from January 21st, 1976. Quote, it's the letterhead or the logo or emblem of, quote, the National Military Command Center, Washington, D.C., quote, memorandum for record, quote, subject report of UFO, Cannon Air Force Base, New Mexico, and I'm going to skip the second reference, but the text here is, quote, the following information was received from the Air Force Operations Center at 0555 EST, end quote, and end quote. Two UFOs are reported near the flight line at Cannon Air Force Base, New Mexico. Security police observing them reported the UFOs to be 25 yards in diameter, gold or silver in color, with blue light on top, hole in the middle, and red light on bottom. Air Force is checking with radar, additionally checking weather inversion data, end quote. And it's from a J.B. Moran, Rear Admiral, USN, Deputy Director for Operations, NMCC. Boy, that's a wonderful document. It shows that this is a real phenomena. Or the people consider or perceiving it to be. And some of the other documents are just, those FOIA documents you've downloaded are remarkable. Thank you so much, Grant.
Yes.
And as you said, you will be sending, there are also additional memoranda here. We don't have time for them, but I hope you'll be a return guest. And I can't wait to see those Kennedy documents.
Yeah, the Kennedy documents were kind of interesting because Kennedy, I think, is sort of, he's sort of become sort of a hard to describe. I mean, sort of like the guy
Michael.
Who didn't do anything wrong. He's like, because he was assassinated. And I think the documents sort of show that he may not have known as people think he knew about UFOs, and that it was actually Robert Kennedy, his brother, was the Attorney General at the time, who was fascinated with UFOs and actually responded to, I don't know how many it was maybe 24 letters that Robert Kennedy writes on UFOs, just fascinating. He comes across very skeptical, but says mm-hmm. he's very interested and basically gives the same sort of pat answer to everybody, but did take the time, and a lot of the letters are handwritten by Robert Kennedy, handwritten letters on UFOs. So there's a lot of material that I've sort of collected over the years, and I've had it, and now I'm sort of going to start putting this stuff up so that everybody can take a look at it and do what they want with it. And because I've been to a lot of libraries and I've pulled a lot of stuff, and I've sort of had it, and I figure, like, my son isn't really interested, and I always sort of, it's always this historic thing, that if I were to die tomorrow, all my stuff would end up in the recycle bin, because my son has no interest in it at all. So the point is that I've seen so many researchers where they've had files, and then you wonder, after they die, you say, like, I mean, this guy must have had wild files, like, well, what about stories he never told? And it's just to get this material out, so that somebody who's researching a particular aspect or time can go and look and see these documents, and it may provide something, you know, 20 years from now, something that will help them along their journey of trying to figure out what's going on as well.
No, that's very informative. And now, Grant, you will be publishing your book, hopefully in the near future. I think it's going to contain very informative, really remarkable material.
Yeah, it's a redo of the original book, which really nothing changed. We had a South African crash case, which I pulled because it got very complex. We did a big update to it, and then I figured, no, I wanted to go with the Area 51. So in the new one, I think I sent you the chapter, we actually have an entire chapter on Area 51 because I found so much more material, which sort of updates that. And I sort of update the MJ-12, which I think is a real phenomena, and I go through why I think the MJ-12 documents were released and what's going on and how that all fits together. So the whole thing, which was part of the original book. And then we have the Walker thing. We go through the whole Walker connection and the Wilbur Smith thing. So it's those four, I think, very key aspects that really haven't been dealt too much in UFOs. But any one of those four aspects, to me, is enough to almost sort of nail down the fact that this is a real phenomena, because I'm dealing with the head of the Canadian government program. I'm dealing with a guy that was president of Penn State University for 16 years, who had 14 honorary doctorate degrees. He wasn't just some guy off the street. And the Bob Lazar case, which I think is a case, I don't care what any people, if you really read the evidence and look at the Bob Lazar case, very strong. It gets stronger the more you look at it. And you'll see people who are very close to the case, they may not have a 100% confirmatory evaluation of it, but they'll say something happened here. Something out of the ordinary happened here at that case. So these are the important aspects that I want to sort of get out. And when it comes, and I still have the presidential book, which I've got all that presidential stuff, which I have to somehow get out one of these days. And then the one story that I think is now being written up that I wanted to write up was the story that I think is probably the most important story in ufology, and that's the Holloman Air Force Base story, the story of Bob Emmenegger and Alan Sandler doing a documentary in the 1970s about a landing at Holloman Air Force Base, which is an absolutely, it's like a Bob Lazar story. The more you look at it, the better that story becomes. It's just an unbelievable story that so many details nobody's ever heard before. So there are a number of good stories. You only have so much time, and I try to do as much as I can to get out the story and let people know. I mean, they can come to their own conclusion, but you need the material. I think I've always sort of had a feeling in UFOs that everybody's sort of got their secrets, everybody's got their secret sources, and that if everybody would come forward and give their secret sources and their stories, we could maybe put this whole story to rest, that everybody sort of is hanging on to the material, not releasing the material, not making it public. I think the more material you've got out there, the more chance there is that people will solve the mystery.
Very well said. And we have 2 minutes left. I hope I'm not being presumptuous here asking you these questions, but we have actually three good questions coming in here from the room audience, our research. Number one, on the Avery, you take the Avery members very seriously, that there was such a group as the Avery.
Well, they are. I mean, they didn't know they were the Avery. Bill Moore gave them all the names. Bill Moore was in contact with all these people like Pandolfi and then Putoff, and there's a whole pile of them. And I've sort of known some of them, and I leaked the story that I was supposed to have held in confidence, and now I'm sort of, nobody really talks to me because they figure I got a big mouth. But I, at one point, I did had interactions with all of them. And they are just people who are people who have had some interaction with the UFO phenomena in their military or their government career, and they're interested in the phenomena, and they sort of interact with each other because they're trying to solve this thing for themselves. My problem is that they're like a group of people who are collecting wild game animals. If those 12 guys figure it out, they're not going to tell anybody. They're going to keep it to themselves. That's my problem, is that they know a lot more than you and I know, and they're working on it on their own personal interests, but they're really not going to tell anybody what discovered. A lot of it's got to do with the fact they have security clearances and stuff, but I did have an interaction with a couple of them at one point, and I did get some material and realize that these people know an awful lot more than you and I know.
Thank you. Can I ask one final question?
Sure.
This is from our researcher, Chip Mine Cemetery. He has a wonderful program, Chip Mine Cemetery. He and his wife present an excellent radio program on these fields. His question to you is, Grant, have you ever run into the film of the landing at the Holloman base? I believe that was the film that was promised to Emmenegger, and then he didn't receive it.
That, I say, is potentially the best story in ufology. I know Bob Emeniger probably better than anybody. Every time I go to the Clinton Library, I stop at his place. I know his wife very well. I stay at his place. I've talked to him 30, 40 times about this case. The story is real. They did have the hull in the Air Force Base landing. If you take a look at their documentaries put out, UFOs Past, Present, and Future in 1974, 1975, there's actually 8 seconds of the film, which is in the, from the hull in the Air Force Base film, is actually in the documentary. We confirmed that later. And they do have a top secret film that they were given by the U.S. military that they still aren't. So it's a very, very important case. And it's a case that I don't think it's gotten nearly the respect that it deserves. There was a Holloman Air Force Base landing. It was filmed. It was offered to them. It was offered to Linda Howe. But Bob Emeniger and Alan Sandler actually had the film in their possession. And a guy by the name of Paul Schartle actually saw the film and went on UFO cover-up live in 1988 and described what was on the film. So there's no doubt they had the film, and there's no doubt there was a landing there. And it appears to be part of what is told to the president when he comes in, that the president may be shown that film. There was some indication that I got that the presidents were shown this film.
Thank you so much for that response. And Grant, thank you so much for just your very informative comments. This was a pleasure to interview you. I learned of a very great deal, as I know our audience did as well. Please consider being a soon return guest. And, of course, your principal website, the President's UFO website, is found at www.presidentialufo.com. Again, www.presidentialufo.com. Any final comments there, Grant?
Well, I appreciate your interest in the thing, and I just... hope that people will, you know, do what they can to record what their phenomena, what their experience is for future generations. That, to me, is the critical thing, because it's an important, people should be honored to have been involved in this phenomena. It is one of the biggest stories in history, and we've had a chance to play a part, and I think everybody should respect the fact that they're playing a role in one of the biggest stories that's ever happened.
Thank you again, Grant, and a great weekend to our listeners. Your time with us is very much appreciated. Thanks for joining the discussion, and to our researchers in the room, thanks so much for those questions. Appreciate it. Good night, everyone.
Rumors spreading round in that Texas town about the shack outside the game. And you know what I'm talking about. Just let me know if you want to go to that home out on the range. They got a lot of nice girls. Everybody.